It's 6 hours, what's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting the UN Security Council prepares to meet and discuss Libya. The UN Security Council is planning an emergency session Wednesday on Libya, where the Islamic State claims to have beheaded 21 Egyptian Christians. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi asked the council to mandate international military intervention. Egypt has already carried out airstrikes on IS targets. University of Pennsylvania Mideast analyst Ian Lustig doesn't think military intervention is likely.
One thing I don't think they're going to be able to do is get a resolution that will approve any kind of UN military intervention in Libya. That's something that the Russians will just not allow, and I don't think that you'll find the British or the EU very interested in engaging in it either.
In Washington, officials from the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain condemned all terrorist acts in Libya, saying the beheadings underscore the urgent need for a political resolution of the Libyan conflict. The International Organization for Migration says more than 900 people arrived on the Italian island Lampedusa as of Tuesday, these latest arrivals among 3,800 rescued at sea since Friday. The executive director of the EU border cooperation agency Frontex, Fabrice Leggeri, says 2015 could see a record number of migrants from the Middle East and Africa.
Because of the geopolitical situation in Syria, in the Middle East, because one can say that in Libya there's a failed state and that there is no government able to have the effective control on the territory, which makes it easier for organized crime to flourish there.
Italy says more than 3,500 migrants arrived in the country by sea in January. Totals for February already have exceeded last month's arrivals. This is VOA News. Attacks by suspected Boko Haram militants in Nigeria killed at least 39 people Tuesday and wounded scores more. Militants attacked a roadblock near the town of Biu in southern Borno State. An explosion and exchange of gunfire killed at least 36. In Potiskum, a suicide bomber detonated explosives at a restaurant, killing at least two others. The French press agency says a policeman was killed when gunfire erupted at an opposition election rally in Okrika in southern Rivers State. AFP quotes the Chadian army as saying two of its soldiers and several militants were killed near Dikwa, about 90 kilometers from the Borno state capital, Maiduguri. In Niger, soldiers shot dead a would-be suicide bomber Monday near the Nigerian border after he tried to detonate explosives near a military checkpoint in Bagara. In the Nigerian capital, Niamey, Tuesday, a pro-government anti-Boko Haram rally was held. Government spokesman Maru Amadou says the rally was aimed at a show of support for Nigerian troops fighting Boko Haram in the Diffa region. Meanwhile, AFP reports purported Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has released a new video vowing to disrupt Nigeria's elections with suicide attacks in the northeast. The U.S. and Turkey have tentatively agreed to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels fighting to topple President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces backed by Hezbollah fighters seized several villages from rebels near Aleppo, Syria's largest city. Aleppo has been one of the centers of fighting, but the UN envoy to Syria Tuesday said fighting might soon cease. Stefan de Mistura told the UN Security Council he received a commitment from Damascus it would stop airstrikes on Aleppo.
The government of Syria has indicated to me its willingness to halt all aerial bombing, all sorts, all types of aerial bombing, and artillery shelling for a period of 6 weeks all over the city of Aleppo from a date which we will be announcing from Damascus.
He said he'll return to Syria to assess whether the government's commitment is possible. Malawi is reportedly on the verge of adopting a law banning child marriages. Parliament last week approved unanimously the bill, which raises the marrying age from 18 to 16. Global health agencies meeting in Kenya Tuesday said AIDS is now the leading cause of death among adolescents in Africa. Agencies including UNAIDS and the World Health Organization met to launch a global campaign called All In, try to reverse that trend. They said in South Africa alone, more than 860 girls and 170 boys became affected with AIDS every week in 2013. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Who is behind Tuesday's election violence in Rivers State, Nigeria?
The PDP abhors violence. We are waiting to get the full report, but we are sure and we believe that our party people cannot be the aggressors in this regard.
Olisa Metu is the National Publicity Secretary of the ruling People's Democratic Party of Nigeria. Gambia is today marking 50 years of independence, but the opposition says the day is meaningless amid oppression. South Sudan warring parties accuse each other of attacking Upper Nile State. And the White House opens an ambitious summit on countering violent extremism.
We're here today because we all understand that in dealing with violent extremism, we need answers that go beyond a military answer. We need answers that go beyond force.
That's U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of a large Somali community, is one of three cities to host a federal pilot project to counter extremism. And Zimbabwe police squashed a peaceful march in commemoration of the Global Day of Action. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The governor of Nigeria's River State, Chibueke Rotimi Amaechi, has blamed the wife of President Goodluck Jonathan for Tuesday's attack on members and supporters of the All Progressive Congress APC party during a campaign rally in Okrika, River State. The governor said he was disappointed over the law enforcement agent's failure to ensure what he called a hitch-free campaign for the APC. Amaechi was elected governor of River State on the PDP ticket before switching to the opposition APC. Olisa Metu, National Publicity Secretary of the PDP, says although the people of River State feel betrayed, the PDP upholds any form of violence.
It was the opposition. It was the APC. The APC had a rally in Port Harcourt, and there was allegedly a bomb blast and some other attacks. Right now, the reports are not very detailed, and we are waiting for comments from our people to know exactly what happened.
Port Harcourt, that's away from Boko Haram region. What's the significance there? Who might have done that now?
There is a big struggle in the River State between the incumbent governor of Rivers, who until about 13 months ago was a prominent member of the PDP, and he left and joined another party. His state people are not very happy about it, believing that they elected him under the platform of the PDP and that they elected him to serve them under the PDP. They had no reason to go and join an opposition party without the authority. So they've been embroiled in some kind of a struggle in the state. That is not an excuse for any violence. The PDP abhors violence. We are waiting to get the full report, but we are sure and we believe that our party people cannot be the aggressors in this regard.
Talking about your party, the ruling party, the former president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, has been kind of a loggerhead with the president, Goodluck Jonathan. The former president went on to accuse President Goodluck Jonathan, saying that the postponement of the election was an attempt by President Jonathan to further stay in power.
Well, I believe there has been appropriate response from the presidency of this issue. The chairman of INEC stated the reason why he postponed the election. The postponement of the election is within the laws of the country, within the electoral laws, within the constitution. There is nothing illegal, there is nothing unlawful, and we believe that that 6 weeks will get INEC ready. What is most important in this regard is the conduct of a free, fair, and credible election.
You mentioned your party's main concern is that free and fair election. Is your party confident that these elections can't even be held and free and fair given the recent intense Boko Haram violence?
We believe it will be held. We know that it's going to be held. Local government elections were conducted in those three affected states, Yobe, Adamawa, Borno, peacefully. Now our military has been engaged because of the recent rearmament by the president, undertaken by the president for our military, and the new multinational task force has been created. They are now focused in raiding those areas of Boko Haram influence and the threat of insurgents.
Olisa Metu is the National Publicity Secretary of the ruling People's Democratic Party of Nigeria. He was speaking with me from Abuja. Today, Wednesday, marks the 50th independence anniversary of the Gambia. Current President Yahya Jammeh, who in 1994 led a bloodless coup d'etat against founding President Sir Dauda Jawara, touts some of his major achievements to include building an airport, hospitals, schools, roads, and even political tolerance. But on December 31st last year, President Jammeh said he foiled an attempt to overthrow his government. Pasamba Jao is the spokesman for the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists in the Diaspora. He says today's 50th independence anniversary means nothing when Gambians are not free politically and economically.
To us, it's nothing but just another day. Ordinarily, it would have been a great day. But given the circumstances of the Gambians on the ground, where there is no political freedom, where economically people are really strangled, like there is no liberty, there is no independence. So you cannot claim to celebrate independence of a nation where the people live under tyranny and dictatorship. So to us, the date is meaningful, but the whole celebration is meaningless because there is nothing to celebrate, because for 50 years, Gambia has had nothing but only two presidents. And for the past 20 years, Gambians have lived under total oppression and subjugation.
You only have to look on the, I was just reading through the Gambian Daily Observer, and there's a litany of achievements that Gambia had made, according to the paper, under President Yahya Jammeh. Gambia established the television, you built the airport, you built hospitals, increased the number of schools, you built roads. I mean, I can go on to keep talking about them. These are some of the achievements, you know, that the paper said were accomplished under President Yahya Jammeh.
Well, I don't expect anything better coming from the Daily Observer, because that's what they are known for, is the mouthpiece of the government. But let's look at their claims of what they call development. Most of the roads that they are talking about, if not all of them, were financed by the EU. That is why today Gambia is one of the most debted countries in Africa. If you talk about the healthcare system, yes, they have erected buildings, but most Gambians today cannot afford even good doctors in a hospital. Most Gambians are dying young because there is no proper medication or medical system that can cure the people when they are sick. So this notion that there is development here and there is nothing but a farce. But again, even if one were to concede that, you know what, there is development, but what is development if the people who live in that country do not have the liberty and the freedom to express themselves?
I'm looking through some of the information they have put on the website. It said, despite an opposition critical of Jammeh's government, the atmosphere of tolerance has always prevailed in the Gambia under President Yahya Jammeh.
Well, James, that is another lie, because as we speak, it was just 10 years ago when Yahya Jammeh gave orders for Dauda Haidara, a journalist, to be gunned down just because he was critical of the government. As we speak today, the opposition parties in the Gambia are denied permits to hold rallies. As we speak today, relatives of people who were accused to have taken part in the December 30th insurgency are still held in detention. And we know that in the Gambia, there is no free press in that country. There is no democracy in this country, So they can say everything they want, but the reality speaks different.
Pasamba Jao is the spokesman for the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists in the Diaspora. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. The United States on Tuesday said it is easing long-standing sanctions against Sudan to allow Americans to send an array of communications hardware and software, including smartphones and laptop computers. The U.S. Treasury Department said the change takes effect immediately and also allows for supplies of radios and digital cameras. A top South Sudan government official is accusing rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar of launching fresh attacks on government positions in Upper Nile State on Tuesday and Monday this week. Lucy Pony of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program reports.
Just one day before peace talks are to resume between government and rebel negotiators in Addis Ababa, South Sudan's Minister of Defense, Kwal Manyang, accused rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar of shelling government forces from a location he identified as Wadakona in Upper Nile State, near the border with Sudan. Manyang says the shelling resulted in the
injury of many civilians and causing also movement of the civil population out of the town and destroying a number of houses.
Manyang says the shelling was concentrated on the towns of Renk and Manyo, located at the northern edge of the oil-producing state.
These are rebel forces who are stationed at Manyo, at Wadakona, which is just exactly near the border of South Sudan and Sudan. This is where they have been mobilizing themselves and getting their own logistics and started moving heavy machinery.
Peter Hoth, the Minister of Information for Upper Nile State, confirmed the reports. SPLM in opposition military spokesman Lul Roy Kong also confirms the clashes began yesterday and continued today, but denies the rebels attacked government positions.
The government troops attacked our positions at a place called Alup, west of Kaki, and the intention was for them to advance on our positions in Wadakona, the administrative headquarters of Manyo County, and we resisted their advances. And while they were trying to advance on our positions, they received artillery fire support and mortar fire support from Rangwijis on the eastern bank. And in the process, we ended up exchanging fires on both sides of the river.
Kong strongly denies the rebels are trying to capture new territory. He says more than 50 government soldiers were killed in yesterday's clashes. The two sides are scheduled to resume talks on Thursday in Addis to reach a comprehensive peace agreement aimed at ending the more than year-long conflict. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
Today's Wednesday, February 18th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Still to come, Marco Uman Sports and our Black History and African History Facts of the Day. And Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A conference bringing together spiritual leaders, police, and representatives from more than 60 countries is underway in Washington, where President Obama hopes to come up with ways to counter violent extremism. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
How to combat violent extremism at its source is a big question that officials from 60 countries and from cities throughout the United States are trying to answer at the summit, which opened Tuesday at the White House. At a roundtable that included officials from Belgium and the Netherlands and local police officials from across the U.S., Vice President Joe Biden called for an approach that goes beyond airstrikes and invasions.
We're here today because we all understand that in dealing with violent extremism, we need answers that go beyond a military answer. We need answers that go beyond force.
Obama administration officials say reaching into America's toughest neighborhoods is key to discrediting the appeals that terrorists might have and to preventing young people who want to escape marginalization and isolation from turning to extremist ideologies. To that end, the White House invited police officials from Los Angeles, Boston, and Minneapolis, whose youth outreach programs are models for ones President Obama would like to set up nationwide. Vice President Biden noted Minneapolis' efforts to engage members of the city's Somali-born population. In a light remark, Mr. Biden compared the inclusion efforts to those of his home city of Wilmington in the U.S. state of Delaware, which also has a community of Somali immigrants.
If you ever come to the train station with me, you'll notice that I have great relations with them because there's an awful lot of driving cabs and are friends of mine, for real.
To some analysts, the remark illustrated the goodwill that exists, but also the work that needs to be done in assimilating America's Muslim recent immigrants. While the question of how to prevent extremism at its roots is too large to answer in a three-day summit, analysts say the meeting is an important first step in finding a solution that goes beyond leading wars on terrorists. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The White House is hosting a two-day summit this week on countering violent extremism. One goal is finding a way to engage communities in order to stop terrorist recruitment. Minneapolis, Minnesota, home to the largest Somali community in the United States, is one of three cities that will host a federal pilot project to counter extremism. Boston and Los Angeles are the other participants. Andrew Luger is the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota. He says the pilot project was built on the needs and interests of the Somali community.
This is an opportunity for Minneapolis, St. Paul, as well as the other cities involved, to share our efforts and our program with leaders involved in countering extremism around the world. And so we hope they will learn from us and that we can learn from them.
There was a pilot project that was implemented, as you mentioned, in Minneapolis and some other cities in the U.S. How much money is the federal government spending in these community outreach projects in Minneapolis area particularly?
sure. We will be learning more about that in the months to come. What we're going to do now is present our plan. We're going to meet with the funders from the federal government, and we'll know more in the months to come exactly how much money they will be directing to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
Some people claim that the program and the money involved may divide the community more than it unites them against extremism. What's your take on that?
This is a program and a plan that was developed with the community and specifically requested by the community. This plan was developed over the course of dozens of meetings with hundreds of community members who explained to us what they believed was needed in the community to combat radicalization. And so the Somali community in Minnesota has been very active in helping build this plan, and the response to it has been overwhelming.
I know somehow you addressed this issue before, but can you explain more your position about the concerns by some community members that the outreach programs could be exploited by the intelligence agencies to gather information on the community?
Sure, that's not possible. The plan is to address the root causes of radicalization as well as the needs within the community to intervene at the earliest stages of radicalization. Again, this is all built on what the community told us would be helpful and necessary to combat the cycle of recruiting that's gone on since 2007, 2008.
Andrew Lugo is the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota. He was speaking with Mohamed Hassan of VOA Somali Service. Zimbabwe police on Tuesday squashed plans by the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe to stage a peaceful march in observance of the internationally recognized Global Day of Action. Police were not immediately available for comment, but the General Secretary of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, Raymond Majongwe, says his union is going to write a letter to the government registering its displeasure over the manner in which the police handle their case.
We were summoned by the police in the morning, and we were told at about 11:45 to bring back a letter at 12 p.m., a 15-minute interval, which was supposed to explain the route that we were going to take. It was also supposed to put to them the number of participants who were going to be the ushers, and we were also supposed to write a letter to the Zimbabwe Republic Police Traffic Section, and it was almost impossible. But the other thing that they were telling us was that we were supposed to produce a letter from the ministry that we were going to be ready to accept our letter. And also, it was a clear impossibility because, one, they knew that the minister was not in an office, so we were told. And secondly, the ministry also was under pressure from the police. I don't know about what. And ultimately, just a few minutes ago, we've just been advised that we cannot undertake that peaceful petition march, but we've been advised to go and commemorate the event in the Harare Gardens.
What are you going to do next?
Apparently, it's very clear. We are going to write a very strong protest letter to government. We are also going to inform Education International and the ILO about this heavy-handedness that has become characteristic of our police. Zimbabwe is not a military police state. We are supposed to be enjoying our rights in a free country where democracy is not just thriving, but is seen to be thriving. And the opposite is true. We are not being allowed to exercise our rights as workers.
That was Raymond Majangwe, Secretary General of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with Jonga Kandemiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria play Guinea at the Orange Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger today, Wednesday. Victory for either side guarantees passage to the semi-finals and qualification for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup later this year. It's a must-win for tournament debutants Zambia and hosts Niger, who clash in the other group, a tie. In athletics, South Africa medical insurance company BestMed stage running, walking and wheelchair races at the High Performance Center, University of Pretoria in South Africa, aimed at raising awareness and funds to treat cancer patients on Saturday. Expecting over 13,000 race entries, BestMed Executive Marketing Manager Chris Late explains their vision.
We've got a long association with cancer. Being a health care provider, medical aid in South Africa, we obviously see a rise in cancer patients. BestMed funds many millions of rands of cancer treatment every year, caring for people that might not be able to afford medical aid. But in general, just making greater awareness. Cancer also sponsors the race with sunscreen, which helps protect the athletes. Some of the proceeds of the race will be going directly towards this non-profit organization.
But this year you have a specific touch, a specific race on cancer. What exactly is this specific race?
Okay. The specific race is creating specific awareness for cancer. The director of the university, Professor Shella Dararay, has posed the challenge to the CEO of BestMed, Mr. Dries Legrandsie, for the fastest between the two of them, the fastest 2 kilometers, and the loser will have to donate specific funds to cancer. And what we've done in addition to it is also the athletes has been requested voluntarily if they'd like to make an additional financial contribution to cancer when entering the event. So we're hoping to raise some significant funds for cancer.
That was Chris Late, Executive Marketing Manager, BestMed Medical Insurance Company, speaking at the University of Pretoria in the South African capital, Tshwane. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 18th. On this day, 1931, African-American novelist Toni Morrison was born in Lorain, Ohio. Most of her writings portray the double-edged character of black lives from inside their own histories and cultures. She also writes about white oppression of blacks. In 1987, Morrison won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel, Beloved. The novel tells the story of a former slave haunted by memories of her life in slavery and how she killed her baby to make sure that the child did not become a slave. In 1993, Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. Did you know that James H. Meredith was the first African-American student to enroll at the University of Mississippi? While attending the all-black Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, Meredith applied to the all-white University of Mississippi. After he was rejected because of his race, Meredith sued for admission, and the university was ordered to admit him. Nearly 3,000 whites rioted to protest Meredith's enrollment in 1962. It took about 23,000 U.S. troops to restore order. Meredith's landmark enrollment at the University of Mississippi and his 1966 Walk Against Fear were central events in the U.S. civil rights movement. And on this day in African history, 1965, Gambia achieved its independence from the United Kingdom. The country is currently led by President Yahya Jammeh, who in 1994 led a bloodless coup d'etat against the founding president, Sir Dauda Jawara. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 18th. Congratulations to Angus Stephen Wara of Bamenda, Northwest Region of Cameroon, and Mwape Kalando of Mpika, Zambia. You are the winners of our February 17th question. During what basketball game did Wilt Chamberlain become the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points? The answer, during the game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Phoenix Suns. Now, here is our question for today, February 18th. Where in Washington, D.C. was Miriam Anderson denied permission to sing in 1939? Once again, where in Washington, D.C. was Miriam Anderson denied permission to sing in 1939? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And the United States on Tuesday said it is easing long-standing sanctions against Sudan to allow Americans to send an array of communication hardware and software, including smartphones and laptop computers. That's it for this Wednesday, February 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Koch, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share.